Welcome back to the Free Code Camp podcast. I'm Quincy Larson, teacher and founder of Free Code Camp, and today I'm interviewing Justin Searles. He's a software engineer who co-founded a software agency 15 years ago, retired at age 38, moved to Japan, and is now writing more software than ever with his fleet of agents. Before we hear from him, I have some cool community news. Free Code Camp just published a free 6-hour course that is going to take you deep into the Kubernetes ecosystem. You'll implement advanced industry standards such as Gateway API for traffic management, cloud native PG for Postgres if you want to manage your Postgres database, and Cert Manager for automating your HTTPS security. By the end of this course, you'll have the confidence to manage production grade environments. This is a 6-hour course on the Free Code Camp YouTube channel. Check it out after you finish listening to this podcast. We also published a comprehensive Notion course. It's not just a fancy notebook. You can use Notion as a full-blown operating system. You can code along with this course at home and build your own task manager using Notion's software Legos philosophy. Then you'll integrate your project with mail and calendar functionality, dashboards, and other advanced features. 12-hour course on the Free Code Camp YouTube channel. We also published this tutorial, learn how to guide agents to write secure code using a robust framework of rules and tests. Software engineer and recent Free Code Camp podcast guest, Shumit Chaha, shares his step-by-step process of building a Node.js shopping cart app using an agent. Instead of just naive one-shotting with prompts, he leverages server-side validation and test-driven development to build out a robust tool. This is well worth reading, and it's not that long of a read. It's about 20 minutes. Check it out. And Free Code Camp also just published a new course that will teach you the Python that you need to know in order to be able to build your own agents. This course starts by teaching you Python syntax and best practices before moving on to popular libraries like NumPy, Pandas, and of course, you're going to get some SQL as well. With these tools in your tool belt, you can manage the data that fuels modern AI tools. That's a 6-hour course on the Free Code Camp YouTube channel. This week's song of the week, I love this band, Uncle from the UK. Their 2003 hypnotic ballad, What Are You to Me? The groove is mostly held together by acoustic guitar and piano on top of layers of synth bass and breakbeats. We also get some soulful laid-back feel from the featured vocalist Joel Cadbury from the band South. This song just melts into the background, and I think you're going to dig it. Support for this podcast comes from 10,321 kind folks who donate to our charity each month. Join them and support our mission at donate.freecodecamp.org. You can also pick up a Free Code Camp shirt and rep the community with pride. $20 with free shipping anywhere in the U.S. Go to shop.freecodecamp.org. Now for the interview, what you've all been waiting for, Justin Searles. He's a software engineer who co-founded an agency 15 years ago, and he has so much insight that he's going to share here. These days, he's gone from solving problems for clients to solving problems for himself and building open source software, often using emerging tools like agents. He says he's getting way more done now than ever before. We talk about how software development is ceasing to be a team sport, how now it is more about individual devs working directly for the people paying them. So clients, freelancing. We talk about how verifiability is everything, whether it's agents contributing to your code base or humans, and how someone just now entering the field can use emerging tools to get an edge over even more experienced developers. Note that I do not censor this podcast at all. If you have young children around, you may want to consider putting on some headphones because Justin has some pretty blunt language here. Justin Searles, welcome to the Free Code Camp podcast.
Hello, how much does it cost?
Free Code Camp is free. Great question. Cool.
Nice.
We are a 501c3 public charity, and we are completely supported by the good folks who support Free Code Camp through a monthly donation. So I want to jump straight to LLM tools. You have said that anyone tracking all this AI stuff and wondering where the job loss is, the clock actually started in February 2025 when Claude Code came out versus 3 years earlier when GitHub Copilot came out. And can you explain what you mean by that and why that 3-year time difference is so important when thinking about the nature of the labor market in terms of developers?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that there's like, when you look at just the programming market, We have experienced a lot of slowdown since 22, 23. We've experienced a lot of layoffs. Some of those layoffs have been, you know, AI in scare quotes has been used as a justification by executives for those layoffs because it's what the market wants to hear, right? Like they wanted to see a pound of flesh regardless, but to say it's because, oh, well, all of these efficiencies through this new magical technology. And so there's a lot of narratives that have formed over the course of several years now. And many of us, whether you stand on the side of, I'm really excited about all these AI tools, or you're terrified of them, or you deny that they have any utility whatsoever. Those narratives have been baked in the cake for several years now, right? And I would say, as somebody who started a screencast series in like early 2023, that was like me fighting with spicy autocomplete version of GitHub Copilot, and who today I write a probably 3% of my code by using, you know, Claude Code, Codex CLI, the difference between what quote unquote AI meant as a programmer prior to the introduction of terminal-based editors. And some people might point to Cursor, but really, like, Cursor's YOLO mode even back then didn't really work that well. And what I'm really talking about here is, like, tell an agent what you want, let it rip, and not have to worry or sweat so much about the details of the code itself. You know, to varying degrees, we can. But point being, like, Claude Code came out the end of February of this year, and it only really got good with the introduction of like Sonnet 3.7. I think that if I remember, it's like May timeframe. Had a dip in the summer where like it just like lost its fucking mind in July and August. So I noped out and switched to Codex, used that for a few months. But like now these things are like, they're starting to, the models, LLMs haven't gotten a lot smarter, but they kind of haven't needed to, because like the Chrome around these tools has gotten increasingly more sophisticated as we introduce hooks and then skills. And now it's like, what I'm working on now is tools to increase the verifiability of that what I'm asking for is actually what is produced, so that I don't have to go in and like rerun a command or inspect things manually myself in between each run. And so like now we're in this like window, right, where it's like we're talking about a universe of less than 12 months. And yet, like, I think a lot of people are walking around with a lot of confidence that they know exactly what this means. Like they know, you know, market's doomed. They're just like, you know, they're drawing a line that goes up and to the right or down and to the right. And they're saying either like, we're never going to have programmers again, or all this stuff is going to explode because like the fundamental economics of AI companies don't make sense. So it's all going to explode and we're going to go back to the old, good old days any day now, right? Like people are walking around like they're really sure what the future holds. And I'm just here to say like, yo, like whatever your kind of priors are about AI, I think we all need to have a little bit more humility and we need to take a fresh look at what these tools are actually capable of. And if regardless of what you've used in the past, like I would encourage every programmer to really try to use something like Claude Code in anger, meaning like force it to write 100% of everything. Just like I used to teach TDD, right? Like, and I'd coach teams on it. I'd say, look, you're not an expert yet. You're a beginner. You don't know. Like if you let yourself say things like, oh, this doesn't need a test, or that's, you know, like I should test drive this kind of thing, but not this kind of thing. I would say like, you don't have the expertise yet to know, right? Like you should test drive 100% of all your code. And only after you've done that successfully, first of all, it's going to teach you how to like test a lot of hard to test things. But second, it's going to, you know, give you the reps and the wisdom to know, really, are you saying that this doesn't need to be tested because it's truly incidental? Or are you saying it because it got too hard, right? I would say the same thing to anyone who's trying to pick up something like or understand something like Claude Code. It'd be like, no, like if it's not working for you, if you're finding, oh, it fucked up. And so you go back into your editor and you start to fix stuff. Like, no, like you figure out how to like, you know, beat the tool into submission to get it to do the outcome that you want. And sure, if after several weeks of doing that, you try your best, you try all these different tricks and you still have a bad outcome, or you know, fine. But downloading it for an afternoon and having it like, you know, fall on its face 20 minutes in, that doesn't count. So all that to say, like we're in a really new space, and if you're a programmer and you haven't really grappled with your identity in the last, call it, I don't know, 9 months or so, you're you don't know anything about AI, is probably what I'd say.
All right. Yeah. So a lot of people are probably going to be listening, and some of them may have done what you recommended, and experimented a little bit, dabbled with these tools, but they didn't force themselves to spend, you know, months and months using these tools to actually get good at bending them to their will. And as such, they may underappreciate how powerful the tools are. That seems to be what you're saying. And also there's just a huge degree of uncertainty. And a lot of the people who are talking about these tools don't really know what's going on with them. They don't have the context because they haven't spent a huge amount of time using them to actually build software.
And when you're trying to talk about like what even is AI, right? Like people might even point to the introduction of Claude Code. And so there was a blog post in September by a fellow named Mike Judge saying like, hey, where's all the shovelware? If AI is so great, where's all this? You know, I'm not seeing new projects announced on Hacker News. I'm not seeing new GitHub. And he had some graphs. And my answer then, because I wrote a response post on my blog like that day or the next day after that blog post blew up, is like, first of all, you know, when we look at this, yes, the timeline started really, really recently. Like, so he'd written that in September. Like, we're talking about a universe of 5 months, and you expect all of this stuff to, like, actually go through the process. Person has an idea, and they go through it all the way to release. Like, give it some more time, right, if the timeline starts later. But the second thing is, I think that, like, the general mindset of programmers as techies, like, oh, they're early adopters. Like, they're always at the leading edge. We use a lot of language like that around programmers. And that's like not my experience at all. Programmers are super fucking sticks in the mud. Like, they're the ones who aren't updating to macOS Tahoe because the icons are all fucked. Like, no, I just had one of my Vision Pro just restarted because the battery doesn't work. Like we're the crotchety ones. And so, when you talk about, like for example, when Node.js came out, 2009, I want to say, Ryan Dahl releases. I remember I was at a conference, CodeMash in Ohio in like 2010, and somebody was doing a little kind of like a hallway chat about Node.js and all these cool uses, and I was like, no, that sounds dumb. And then in 2011, by then I'd started using it, and I started doing it for like scaffolding of front-end tools. And it was probably another 2.5-3 solid years before I had a client even let us use it in production, because they had a Red Hat Enterprise Linux, you know, like the timeline of the, like, normal people, normal developers weren't using Node.js until like Create React app came out. And so we look at that, and that's like 6 years later, 7 years later. And so for this expectation that everyone's using Claude Code the minute it came out because it's been on the front page of Hacker News, is like, you're talking about like maybe 5% of developers globally have touched it. We're not talking about a lot of people. Most people are not terminably online. Most people are clocking in and out of their jobs, and they're just doing the same shit that they've been doing every day. And so like if we're already, and as of yesterday, Jared Santo put out a blog post being like, actually, you're starting to see this graph hockey stick, the number of new project announcements. Like, you are starting to see a ton of, call it slop, call it additional capacity. Like the code is coming, and that's coming from such a small minority of developers out there that, like, once this becomes a standard issue tool that everyone is using, and 10 years from now, however long it takes, we're going to be seeing orders of magnitude new software like created. And so that's why I think that there's just a little bit too much premature, you know, declaration of failure or success by people who've, right, who've got entrenched interests as to like, what is AI and what does it mean for the future?
Well, yeah, like a vast majority of developers I would categorize as like anti LLM generated code because it does hallucinate. There are shortcomings of it, but they don't necessarily understand that there are dramatic, you know, benefits to just having the sheer amount of speed and volume that you can get from it once you figure out how to work around those constraints of having to, you know, test it more rigorously, which I know you mentioned TDD and test-driven development and your efforts to try to teach people like, hey, you like, a lot of times people are just refusing to write tests because it's hard, not because it's not important to write a test for this particular functionality or something like that, right? So a lot of what you're doing, I guess, through your blog and your podcast, not that you're like a paid industry representative or anything like that, is just going out and like kind of waking people up to the fact that like, okay, this is, we're very new in this. Yes. Like a lot of the things that people are saying on, you know, our programming, the subreddit, great subreddit, but very strong anti LLM bias that I've observed there. Like they published some, you know, low sample size study of like people trying to use coding, and that gets shoots to the top because it's critical of these tools, for example. So it's like confirmation bias. People want to believe that these tools are not all that great, so they don't have to bother learning them. And they don't have to spend all this hard, you know, time, this process, essentially retraining themselves how they do software development. It does kind of jive with like your explanation of TDD. TDD was like this new paradigm of writing software by writing the test first, and figuring out what the functionality you want and then testing it. And then once you've got that in place, then writing the code to get the tests to pass. And a lot of people advocated that and they got things done in a more robust way than the old way, which was trying to like, okay, quick, I need to submit this PR. Like I got to come up with a couple tests so they don't reject my PR. Right. I don't know if that's a fair description of TDD and your efforts to try to get people to adopt it, because the agency you ran was literally called Test Double and it was focused on like testing and maintainability, right?
What I think a lot of people mistake, and when at Test Double, when recruiting people, you know, I think we're at like 150 developers now. And I, one of my things I'm proudest about at Test Double is how, successful the company's been at attracting and retaining a particular kind of person, because we did attract a lot of people, a lot of recruits who would hear me talk about testing or TDD or Agile, and they would think, okay, this guy gets it. He's got like exactly the correct formula for like how to write good software. And he agrees with me about everything. And they had a kind of fixed mindset about what that meant. And like they, you know, and I would categorize these as people who liked coding for coding's sake or testing for testing's sake. And for me, they were a means to an end. And so what we try to do in our interviews is like filter out people who were just there because they wanted to be adherence to some zealous religious cause, and instead find ourselves attracted to people who are like, no, like what I want to deliver as a programmer is business value for a client or for a company to either make or save them money. And if I believe that like currently the best way to arrive at a good outcome is to measure twice and cut once by doing something like test-driven development, then that's the thing I'm going to do. And now, so why did Justin care a lot about testing and teach a lot of people about that? Because at the time, that was the best tool available to do it. And because at the end of the day, most software sucks, doesn't do what it's supposed to do. The rework and the amount of like, you know, failed projects is so massive that if you can, it really came down to verifiability. Do I have an automated, fast, and rapid feedback loop that verifies that the code does what it's supposed to do? And that's why today, even though I'm not practicing TDD by hand, I'm not writing code by hand, pretty much all of my thinking about Claude Code or Codex CLI and my disappointment with the kind of West Coast Python data-driven developers who don't know any of this fucking shit, who are building these tools at OpenAI and at Anthropic, I'm eminently disappointed by everyone in the AI sphere who fancies themselves an engineer or a tool maker, because like none of them came from the Midwest United States where like we had the blue collar Agile and software craftsmanship movement that really cared about like how to generate ROI for blue chip enterprise organizations. Because if the AI tools were built by people more like us, verifiability, reinforcement learning, like how to actually, we would never have developed something like a Claude Code that just says job's done and be like, okay, did you run the tests? No. Did you write any new tests? No. Like all of this would have started with, okay, nothing happens. Nothing happens at all until like when the programmer asks for something to be built or specifies it, like job one is figure out like, how do I write a failing test that would successfully articulate like and express the requirement or the need, and the, how do I encode that in a way that's really fast to make sure that it never breaks in the future. And the tools aren't there yet. And the tools really like if you're using these AI tools, like I am every day, They put all of that work of how to verify that things are actually working on the individual developer to beat something like Claude Code into submission. So for me, when you talk about TDD, and I just went on a, you know, little bit of a rant there. It's about right now, the most interesting problem in AI is not the capacity and the relentlessness with which these agents can produce stuff. It's about the wisdom and the rigor that individual practitioners need to take to try to enforce verifiability, that they're actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. And maybe the tools will get better at someday on that front. But right now, that's where the heat is.
Okay, so trying to enforce verifiability, like these are fundamentally, you know, stochastic tools, and you want some degree of determinism. Like you want bounds, essentially, so that it doesn't go off and think that it should delete production database and stuff like that. Like you hear all these horror stories of people who, I guess, are giving the LLM tools, like the agents, way more credit than they are due. But it sounds like you approach these tools like they're extremely dumb, and you're constantly thinking about, okay, how do I prevent it from doing dumb things?
This comes naturally to me because I also assume people are really fucking dumb. Because, like, I'm a low trust individual. You know, I don't trust myself because, like, the stupidest person on the planet is me yesterday. Like, whenever I think of past me, like, oh, like me on a project 3 years ago, I was like, oh, I was so dumb, right? Whenever I'm looking at a colleague or somebody, it's sort of like how this zero trust security model of, like, how we should think about security, where no good secure system should rely on trust. Should rely on encryption or, you know, verifiability. I'm that way with, like, people, right? So when you say LLMs hallucinate and that makes them bad, it's like people fucking hallucinate. Like they make mistakes all the time. And the difference with LLMs is, like, they do the same stuff. They're just so fast and they can do it so relentlessly. Like, now we have to just either way, whether we're dealing with a human developer or an automaton that just produces stochastic output, like, we need a way to harness that and formalize it. So, like, yes, a conversation with ChatGPT can just kind of go off into nonsense, world where we're just in fantasy land. So can a conversation with Claude Code. The difference is, like, software can be deterministic. So get it to write the software that's deterministic, and the most important piece of software that you're going to write is, like, the thing that verifies that, like, the thing that's being built is actually working, so that you don't need to come back and, like, and find yourself just walking in circles over and over and over again, which is really quickly where you end up in version 2 of any app that's built with a coding agent.
Yeah, and to be 100% clear, that most important part of software is the tests, is what you seem to be saying. Like that if you don't have, like, a proper robust test suite where you've really thought through all the different corner cases, then you're taking a huge risk really trying to build anything yourself or relying on agents trying to build stuff for you.
One way to look at it, right, is a theory of constraints. And if we think about speed as being how long does it take, how much wall time or calendar days elapse between where we are today and a finished product, having deterministic and, like, solid, like, the ability to take forward steps where you can confidently know you're never going to have, like, a backslide, requires you to go, like, slow, right? You talked about it earlier. It's sort of like the slow makes smooth and smooth makes fast mindset. Like, if we're working with an agent, and let's say it's building really good code, but, like, I'm struggling with this right now, just to be honest. Like, this stuff's a lot easier to verify if it's just stock standard web applications, but I'm building, like, an iOS 26 app in Liquid Glass where, like, not even Apple has good examples of, like, what good code looks like, and where even, like, you know, APIs are broken and the simulator is really hard to, like, automate, right? And then the simulator can't even do everything. And so, like, the devices are absolutely not automatable. And so, like, how do I get Claude Code to make sure that the button feels good, right? Like, I can't. So right now I'm constrained. Like, what's the theory of constraints say about, like, my current iOS 26 development cycle? At least when it comes to UI, it's like, all right, well, I got to click build and run. I got to wait some number of seconds to, like, launch it in the app. And then I got to click all these things in the right order. And then I got to make a judgment. And then I have to go do the extra work of articulating or documenting or screenshotting that back to Claude Code and feeding it back in. So this is, like, a real pain point for me right now. And so I'm losing sleep over. How do I close the loop, remove myself from that loop? Because the relentlessness and the speed with which something like a Claude code, a coding agent, can continue to iterate without me there. As long as I'm there, as long as I'm that constraint, like the number of calendar days that are going to lapse are really, really long. And so that's why I keep coming back to like verifiability is once you have that rigorous verification loop, then you can remove the human from it. And then you can actually take advantage of the speed of these things and not be thinking about the hallucination stuff so much or caring about it, so to speak.
Right. So, you know, humans have always been kind of a constraint in programming. And it sounds like to the extent that you can remove yourself, just like with traditional software, if I want to go like browse a bunch of websites and like get data from them, that takes forever because I'm manually having to click and I'm waiting for all the latency of the connection and all that stuff. And if I write a scraper to go and grab all that data for all those data for me, then it can just be scaled horizontally to the number of machines that I have. And, you know, things can move very quickly when they're on silicon time instead of on carbon time.
Absolutely. And what I think is really interesting about this current moment is that if you are a developer who bases your activities from some kind of first principles, you know, what you just said is an expression of Larry Wall's, you know, the three virtues of a programmer. Larry Wall wrote Perl back in the day. Is laziness is one of them, right? Like, I'm lazy. I don't want to have to go this morning. What was I doing? I had Claude Code actually go to the Stripe managed membership pages for Kagi and OpenAI, download all my 2025 invoices, build me a table of summing up all of the like how much I paid, and then zipping up all those PDFs into a zip, and then adding them to my spreadsheet for my expense reporting for Searles LLC. You know, like, it did that for me. That was a chore that I've been putting off for 2 weeks because I didn't want to have to click that many times, and I'm just having it do it for me, right? And so like, this is just the same sort of expression as like 10 years ago when I wrote Finance, which is like a little scraper web app thing that would go to all of my bank statements and kind of aggregate all of our personal finances and budget and credit cards and all that stuff into a nice chart, is the same sort of thing as if you'd been, my late grandfather had a TI-99-4A that he stood in line at a Radio Shack for in 1981 to buy on launch day. And he was still to the point, like to the day he died, in the 2010s, was still using that to write little programs for his home mortgage, you know, amortization schedule and stuff. Like, it's the same impulse that's been there all along, and the tools change, but fundamentally the principles don't.
Okay, so laziness as a virtue from Larry Wall. Essentially, if you have the inclination to figure out a way to not have to do work and to offload that work to the machines, that's a virtue in the world of programming, even though laziness, you know, sloth was one of the seven deadly sins, times have changed. And that's actually going to help you do a lot more over the long run. I want to talk a little bit about the perception of these tools. Let's concede that these tools are going to continue to get better, not because LLMs are fundamentally going to get better, but because the Chrome around them, as you called it, is going to continue to get better. We're going to get like reasoning models that are basically using the same LLMs, but they're just getting way better at figuring out how to rein in the LLM's worst tendency and keep it on track or have it build upon its own work and things like that. And certainly there are probably a lot of equivalents with LLM code generation that we can talk about. But when people hear about these things, a quote that you have is, some people see a bomb, I see a rocket ship. A lot of people are scared, but in the same amount of, I guess, explosive material, you can build a bomb or you can build a rocket that directs it and launches something, you know, up to escape velocity, right? Like, what would you say to somebody who's currently looking at these LLM tools like they're a bomb to help them see how maybe this could serve as a rocket ship instead?
I think one of the things that's most interesting right now is that you can look at a team of people who like really get along. They've been working really well together for years. Maybe they're, mix of staff and principal and senior and junior developers, and they all kind of work the same way and they all seem to have the same opinions about everything. But then this AI thing comes along and 70% of everyone hates it for different stated reasons. You know, they hallucinate, or like, you know, it's going to destroy the planet or whatever the reason is. And 30% of people are just like the happiest they've ever been as developers. They're showing up to stand up every day, and they're like, look at these 20 things I built yesterday. And it's like they found religion. And why is it that we are suddenly getting carved through, like, as an industry, in this new novel way where it's like, yeah, like when I was talking, joking about like Midwest versus coastal developers, right? Where like the Midwestern ones tended to be more bought into the slow code movement of the 2000s and 2010s. Whereas on the coast, the money was a lot easier and you didn't have to prove things worked in order to, like, you know, get a fat payday. Like that organizing principle was geographic. It was also kind of temperamental in terms of who it attracted. And here, what we're finding is that the thing that divides people now, in my opinion, is a mix of how opinionated are you? Like, do you have a theory of the case? Could you write an editorial about how you think software should be? And ambitious. Like, how ambitious are you to, like, how many ideas do you have? Creative ideas of things you just want to force into existence out there. You know, and for as a content creator, right? That's like, how many blog posts would I want to write? How many podcasts would I want to record? How many open source libraries would I want to create? How many product ideas do I have that I wish I could make out there? Versus, you know, some people, they want the job to be a job. Maybe they have other priorities in their life. Maybe the family comes first, or maybe they got other passions and they just want to be able to clock in at 9 o'clock and then clock out at 5 o'clock every day and be told, these are the requirements, and they want to just do the requirements. And on any given team of, you know, I can think of staff level people, right? Who some fall in that first bucket and some fall in that second bucket, and they both provide a great amount of value to their employer. What's changing now, and why some of these people in the latter category feel under threat, is that if you show up to just fulfill requirements as stated, and treat that as what the job is, the amount of value that you provide your employer is asymptotically going to go to zero when the order takers just become the agents. And you were like, what provides business value is actually having that ambition, the creative idea of like, what's next? How can I make it better? How can I get lazier, to take that previous example? And how do I articulate in a way and shape this tool in order to get better and better and better outcomes? And that's the new dividing line that I'm seeing between teams. And so that's what I say, like, you know, if you're one of those ambitious people who just sees these things, is like, holy shit, look at all this stuff that I can build. I can finally do this. And like, why am I wasting time clicking around in my expense reporting when I could have it do this? Like if you're that kind of person, you see these things as like a rocket ship. Like, I'm going to free up so much more time. And then I can, you know, I can do that to go and spend time with my kids, or I can spend it to go build more stuff. Or you see it as a bomb. You see it as like, this is an existential threat to my identity as a programmer. This is the thing that's going to, like, you know, I might not make it in the next round of layoffs, right? Or like, how could I ever pass a job? Like all the jobs are going away because no one wants to hire somebody without having these massively high expectations for their output. And I can't do that, right? That's not realistic. And that's, I think, that's the cleavage that we should be talking about more explicitly. Whereas in the past, it was sort of considered improper to be like, well, you know, Dave over here is really ambitious, but Ross over here really is kind of just an order taker.
Yeah. So to some extent, this isn't really that different from like doctors who just want to have a job and they don't want to go start their own practice, and they're beholden to the hospital system as a result. They're kind of like the air quotes order takers in this example, or musicians who just want to play music, but don't want to like go and play the TikTok game for all its toxicity. Like, the game has fundamentally changed, seems to be what you're arguing. And the people who merely just view this as a job and they've got their skills and the craftsmen, like, because the game has changed, those people need to change with it, or they are going to find themselves out of job, is what you would argue.
At the end of the day, like, if you like coding for the sake of coding, that's awesome. And I like it too. And it's great to have a hobby And if as a hobby, you do the Advent of Code, you know, that's a popular thing every December. People have these coding quizzes. They do the coding quizzes. It's a fun mental challenge. It's kind of like doing Sudoku, but really hard. You know, that's pretty cool. That's an individual pursuit and a passion that I have that probably a lot of people listening to this have. Now, if you want to make a six-figure salary, that's a different question. Because now there's somebody else involved in this equation, and that's the person paying your paychecks. And you have to, and have always had to, demonstrate a certain amount of business value to the business. Ideally, more like a greater, you should be either saving them or making them more money than they are paying you. Otherwise, it's pretty foolish that they're paying you so much. And developers had a pretty plum gig in the 2010s because the money was coming easily with the zero interest rate phenomenon. And because there was just these exits that people were experiencing were so high, the developer suddenly went from being a middle-class job to a firmly upper-middle-class job, as a lot of other professions were suffering. And so I think we all are walking around now being like, well, being a programmer, you know, how many people who went through Free Code Camp got there because somebody in their life told them that to escape their, you know, career prospects, they need to learn to code. It's not something inherent about coders being valuable. You got to think about it in terms of what's the value that I'm providing my employer. And if you just aren't wired to think that way, or, you know, for whatever reason, you know, aren't comfortable or don't want to have to think that way about your job, then yeah, you are under threat. But if you really want to be valuable to the people around you, which is kind of how I'm always oriented, is if I'm going to spend my time on this, I want to be useful. Then the amount of value that you can create as a programmer has never been greater than it is right now.
Yeah. And that's a great way to think about, I think, just the nature of reality. Like, everybody's essentially singing for their supper, or like trying to go and like get the calories and bring them back to their family, right? So that everybody can eat, and somebody has to give you those calories, right? Or you have to, you know, get your salt from the Roman, you know, army, and then go sell that salt and turn that into you know, bread for your kids or something like that, right? Like, it's always at the end of the day, what value is created, and then the value is somehow given back to you for you creating value. And that may not be equitable. There are plenty of jobs where you could look at the employment situation is extremely exploitative, but programmers, I think they've already demonstrated a certain degree of curiosity, a certain degree of grit by being able to get good at communicating with machines, which are notoriously stubborn, through the process of programming, which itself is it's a pretty difficult skill to acquire. So given that, they should be able to also be flexible. And what you seem to be saying is there are still a lot of people who maybe have forgotten that flexibility. Maybe they've lost that neuroplasticity, or maybe they've just gotten accustomed to not having to work so hard and think so hard. But those people are going to need to adapt, is what you're saying, if they wish to continue.
Even in prior eras, we would always be talking about how change is constant in this industry. Maybe it's, you know, in the past, it was new programming languages, new operating systems, new paradigms, like as we moved further and further up the stack, right? Like, where 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you might have been expected to be writing in assembly and then in C, and then you go up, and now it's like the Gang of Four book in the 90s. Like, that was fundamentally, it was really where it kind of introduced the idea of design patterns. Go back and read that book, and it's really about like desktop publishing software, right? And like user interfaces, and like what was demanded of software at that level of abstraction is very different than what was demanded 10, 15 years later when the book got popular in terms of like web development, right? Now you're building a Ruby on Rails app, like some of those lessons are useful, but like the thing that's like fundamental is here's a way to look at it. And I come back to this often because I think this visual is really helpful, especially when you're trying to conceptualize the skill of programming and like the action of it, is I think about a pyramid where at the bottom layer are your values, right? Like values that are like eternal. They don't change. Things like integrity or curiosity, right? Or this desire to be valuable to others and to serve others. Like, those are fundamental, like deep-seated human things. And then the next layer up in the pyramid are your principles, You know, these are things that I fundamentally like when they tend not to change very often, and they tend not to change like within a domain. You know, things like verifiability for me, like I spoke to earlier, is definitely one that I have in software, right? Is like, I don't want to waste my time writing software that I can't verify works. And I understand that like fast feedback loops, another principle of mine, is like, I can go faster and everything works out better if I'm able to shorten the iteration time and do the, you know, minimize the a number of pipeline stages in how I develop software. And then like the very, very top of this pyramid are the actual like activities that we're doing, like the, an activity right there that affects both of the, or is built on both those principles, is test-driven development. So I'm doing test-driven development, but like the top of the pyramid changes over time. It changes with context all the time. It's changing now in terms of what I'm doing. And I think a lot of people miss this because it's like an iceberg, and like all we see from other people is that top of the pyramid, is what activities are they doing. And we infer their principles and their values from it. But if we don't think about our own pyramid, if we don't think about what are our own values, what are our own principles, and conceptualize those as being the longer term, more stable things, and then hold a little bit less firmly the activities, the particular, oh, well, like I want to be like Justin because he does TDD. And then when Justin stops doing TDD, like that person has a crisis of conscience, you know, like no, like what I care about was verifiability. And we just never had that conversation because you didn't get to see that. You just saw me writing a lot of tests.
Okay. Awesome. That's helpful. So just to recapitulate what you said, the pyramid top part, which is the implementation details of how you get things done, is more visible than the underlying principles and underlying that the human values. And because those ones at the top are visible, then you don't get the full picture when you're just looking at somebody's obvious, like visible actions. What is actually motivating those? But the underlying motivation for most people is going to be, hey, I want to get money so I can pay for my house and make sure my kids have plenty to eat and things like that, right? At the end of the day, like FreeCodeCamp has been an extremely pragmatic organization in that we've always focused on skills that we think can help people improve their lot in life, essentially. They can help people like change from like, okay, my dad was a plumber and I want to be a developer, and then maybe my kid can be like a scientist or something like that, right? Like kind of moving up the proverbial social or perceived value or prestige in society, however you want to think about this. For FreeCodeCamp, the main operative question is like, what should we advise people to do? Like, how can we responsibly guide their scarce time and resource, like, and help them get skills to pay the proverbial bills? So one of the questions I have for you is, I've talked with lots of people over the years on this podcast who have differing degrees of like the amount that you should mix AI tools into your like learning regimen, if you will. At what point should you introduce them? How should you go about it? Let's talk with the current state of tools. What proportion of time do you think somebody who is, let's say they're working as like a truck driver, right? They are just getting into the field with minimal knowledge of how computers work, of how software gets written, like what percentage of their time and at what point should they earnestly adopt, for example, using agents to write their code for them?
So in terms of percentage breakdown for somebody who's just starting out, this might be a little bit unusual. I would say you should spend 100% of your time focused on the fundamentals and the learning and the principles and the foundational pieces of like, what even is software? How does it work? How is good code structured and organized? And then also 100% of your time engaging with AI agents. Like for me, the question feels like a false dichotomy because it would be like saying like, what percentage of your time should you be like learning computer science concepts? And what percentage of your time should you be learning your code editor? Like it's, those are orthogonal to me. Cause I think like, frankly, having a coding agent or having an LLM with tools like the ability to search the web and then like, you know, compress and like understand a whole lot of, you know, books worth of data in order to like, you know, craft a reply that is personally tailored just to your context in this moment. That is the best education system that's ever existed. That is the best. If you are again, we talk about like people who lean forward versus lean back with AI tools. If you're the more ambitiously oriented, forward-leaning person, like you should look at this current lay of the land and be like, I don't have the patience to go to a 4-year computer science program that's going to teach me just stock, slow lectures of just generic computer science stuff over a syllabus over a period of months, when I could just like, you know, have a personalized instructor that can move as fast as me, can work 24 hours a day and build me custom tailored, you know, programming exercises that are like, I don't know, say you're a big Harry Potter fan or something. You could say like, all right, build me like based on the, you're just teaching me about red black lists or whatever, or red black trees. Like I want to learn how to program this data structure. Like give me an example from the Harry Potter universe that like, you know, does this and solves a riddle and it'll make some shit up. Right. Like it can create engaging and individualized educational content for you. And these agents are all customizable. Like when I was talking about verifiability earlier, I'm talking about a combination of Git hooks, Claude hooks, Claude skills, and Claude.md, or the, you know, there are equivalents for Codex CLI and Gemini and so forth. Like you can use all of those same basic primitives as a beginner developer to be like, hey, maybe your Claude.md says, whoa, 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 pump the brakes. I'm a new developer and I'm actually not here to ship software. I am here to learn. And so I don't want you to do anything without explaining every single line of code. So like we're going to go through and interactively commit and like, you know, and you can steer it towards being the kind of agent that you need for your personal development. And so for that reason, I'd be like, yes, 100% to both.
Okay. But like, let's say there's a risk that people just become overly dependent on these tools and don't necessarily develop the critical thinking facilities for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and there's like a risk that there's a risk that you drive a car and you just like refuse to ever use the brakes. Like you might just like run off a cliff. Like that is a risk, but like
it's a lot easier when you're driving a car to know like, hey, I'm going too fast. I need to slow down. Then, I mean, people are like literally committing suicide from having these lengthy discussions with these tools and essentially misunderstanding the nature of reality, misunderstanding because they've gone so far down
the
rabbit hole.
If you can listen to this podcast and understand what I'm saying and have metacognition to know that, like, yeah, sometimes you're going to I've been doing this for over 20 years. And 2-3 days ago, I was at my wit's end because I was using Claude code to try to like, you know, build something. And I was being lazy and I was like, just rapid firing, like, and then do this and then do this and then do this. And then it starts making a mess. And then I start getting into this loop of like, hey, this is a regression. God damn it. Like go back. And now I'm getting frustrated. And like, I caught myself. Right. And I was like, oh, you know what? This is no longer serving the purpose it's supposed to for me. I'm going to pause. I'm going to call this afternoon, you know, a learning opportunity for like being a little bit more rigorous and diligent and disciplined about my approach to this. And I'm going to do it differently. If you're a beginner and you have that same sort of ability to metacognate as a human and that same self-awareness, you're going to be fine. And if you don't, you are fucked, my friend. Like, that's it. It's not about tools. It's about your capability and capacity as a human being.
I mean, I understand that, but to some extent, like a lot of people learn critical thinking and learn problem solving skills in the process of programming. And you're somebody who's been programming for, I don't know, like 20 plus years, right. You've taught people programming, you've built like a successful software development consultancy products, all this stuff. Like you have the benefit of having decades of, you know, experience with these types of systems, understanding the fundamentals. I don't know if you got a CS degree, but you actually have a whole lot of what a truck driver would not necessarily have. And the amount of rigor that the human brain develops by working with machines and trying to convince them to do this very specific thing and communicate this very specific thing. I mean, code is essentially like an extremely detailed spec. And you have to have this mental rigor that most human beings do not have. Like the average politician, the average, person out there who's really doing anything, the people who are working at McDonald's, places like that, like they wouldn't necessarily have that degree of rigor. And I guess I just want to kind of mediate or moderate what you're saying a little bit with you are like a kind of a consummate professional already. Like you are already in like the probably top one percentile of developers. Again, you can disagree with that if you want to be humble, but it's easy for you to say that is what people are thinking when they're listening to this. It's easy for you to say you can recognize that you're spiraling or you're wasting your time or that you need to pump the proverbial brakes.
That's all completely 100% valid, and I appreciate it. But I think it fundamentally comes down to where does critical thinking come from and where does that sort of like, you know, that divide of like what, like a human temperament come from? Because frankly, you know, you take the example of somebody learning today with the benefit of all of these tools and you compare it to my experience learning how to program. I think my very first experience trying to learn how to program was I was at a Borders bookstore in Michigan as a fifth, sixth, seventh grader. And it was like, Sam's learned C++ in 24 hours. And it was absolutely terrible, or 24 days. One of those. And it was absolutely terrible experience. It made me feel really stupid. And I gave up for a couple of years. My computer science degree, I do have one. And I went to the college and spent 4 years feeling just stupid as fuck. Every single class, B, C student, tried really hard. I'd be up in the lab with like two liters of Mountain Dew, and because the door's locked, I'd have to prop it open and use that bathroom. So I was on the third floor of the only person in the math and CS building. And I'd be there and I'd work, you know, didn't have the tooling to like help. We had like literally a 3-ring binder with like the full Java 1.3 or whatever it was API written. And you had to flip through it. You know, I had no support, had no one, you know, I guess I could use AltaVista or Google or whatever to like figure out like some sort of like way to navigate my Linux command. But like I wasted those 4 years. I graduated and my counselor, who was like one of the CS professors, his advice to me was literally, Justin, you're really smart. You've got a, like, you're a great critical thinker. You're a good communicator. Maybe you should think about a profession that doesn't have you programming. Like, that's what I'm talking about, man. Like, yes, you're right. Some people lack the rigor and ambition, and I find that has absolutely zero fucking correlation with how much, like, professional programming experience they have. It is
okay.
Who you are and how you're wired.
Okay, so, like, let's say hypothetically somebody just isn't wired, air quotes, wired that way. Like, I happen to believe that, you know, nurture is way more important than nature in the state of, like, how people turn out, right? And, like, some social scientist who has, you know, a bunch of, like, paperwork can tell me otherwise. But that's my current thinking. Like, if you take just some person who has zero background in, you know, math, programming, computer science, but they are innately curious and interesting and stuff like, yeah, they're going to probably succeed. Just like, you know, people that grew up in like some village where they didn't even have like an internet connection and stuff like that. They are able to ultimately get like an internet connection and catch up with everybody just because that's how they're wired and stuff. But let's take somebody who, just like was kind of mediocre like me. Like I was pretty mediocre up into my 20s and I didn't really do much that was that interesting, and I didn't have those skills. How would you go about getting those skills and like not necessarily skills, but like those properties of curiosity and like being determined to get things done right and not settling for like mediocre, you know, like a mediocre project, like that obsessive drive to make sure that the program does exactly what you want it to do and not just saying, oh, that's good enough.
I think you're 100% right, first of all, because when I say like, you know, like some people are this way and some people are that way, I'm talking about like, how are they showing up in the moment? But like, fundamentally, I believe pretty much every single human, you know, who's blessed with good health, right? Mental and physical well-being has the capability to express themselves as the kind of critical thinker that I'm describing. And in early on, you know, anyone listening to this, no one's going to listen to this and think like, oh yeah, I'm one of the people who lacks self-awareness, right? Like everyone is the hero of their own story. And so I'm sure everyone listening to this is like, yes, I am like, you know, like I've got self-awareness. I've got like, you know, like I am dialed in. You're listening to a goddamn podcast on how to be better as a programmer. So like for, even if you got low self-esteem or something, you're doing something right. Like when I was starting out my consulting career, I saw lots of kinds of consultants out there, and the consultants that I respected and sought out as mentors, and then I tried to emulate myself, were the ones you'd walk into a room, and like as a consultant, you're always coming into a room, and it's the reason you're there is something's not going right. They want to make something better. They see this team, and they're like, this team is failing, right? And you look at it there, and like the easiest thing to do as a consultant is to walk in and be like, oh, that's because they're all fucking numbskulls. They're all stupid, and they're bad, and you should replace them, right? Or, you know, maybe one notch above that in the ladder of unhelpful consultant things you could do is like, all right, well, the reason that they're suffering is they haven't done my patented process of like how to be a better person and a better programmer and a better teammate. And like you need my training and you go through my training to act just like me and then they'll be all better. Right. But like every time I walked into a room, what I would see is, okay, so there's these five people here. Like they're not outputting what the company wants. Structurally, they exist in an environment and they're operating under incentives. And like those structural things that are surrounding them, probably to your point about nurture, probably explain way more about like why they're not succeeding or meeting the business's expectations than anything that's intrinsic to them as humans. Cause like you start peeling back the layers of the onion and you realize, oh, actually like you are actively incentivizing them not to create the database columns they need because you've given them 15 sheets of like forms to fill out. And then they got to go argue with the meanest people in your organization, the DBAs, to get those things approved. And then they got to go, if they have anything on that list, then they got to go to a quarterly change management meeting where they got to talk to the head of change management whose job it is to prevent change in your organization. Like, so no wonder they like keep their heads down and mostly don't do new stuff because you've built a system that makes them not want to do that. Or maybe you have them working in an office space that's really loud and noisy and has light or super bright fluorescent lights. Or maybe the coffee sucks, right? Like all of these things, or you know, the hours they work or their commutes are terrible. Like all of these things are factors that affect us as humans and they affect how we show up in different environments. And so like, I'm all about explaining like only as an absolute last resort as a consultant would I ever like let myself even think it was something innate about the individual that's preventing them from being successful. It's always something around and like something systemically, something like in the structure of like where they're working. But like fundamentally at this point in the game, you know, it not to say it's like no longer a team sport, but what we're seeing now is that the capabilities of AI are so phenomenal for accelerating the individual pursuits of individual developers that if you are on a team and you are, for whatever structural or environmental or personal reason, not able to show up to your job with that level of curiosity, ambition, creativity, and a desire to like create business value for your employer, I would say you probably have about 9 months to figure it out or to like cut your fixed expenses and prepare for unemployment.
Okay. So question for people who are not yet in that cubicle at that office where their environment sucks. It's got bad coffee. It's got a bad commute. It's got a manager who's overly invasive. Like they're not even there yet. They are on the outside trying to get some form of sustenance through software development.
Yeah.
Like how would you proceed? Let's say you do have some fundamental skills because you've been working through FreeCodeCamp for like a year or two. You've built a bunch of projects. Maybe you've gotten a couple client projects and things like that. How would you approach that 9 month timeline, right? Before you become a member of, I think what I've heard called is like the permanent economic underclass of people that just don't have soluble skills. And, you know, you're not able to get in. What advice would you have to those people that are still trying to get in?
Honestly, if you've got a full-time job right now and it's draining you to the extent that I'm describing or trying to paint a picture of, you're in trouble because you probably lack the mental freshness and the zest and the zeal to approach programming right now with the level of creativity and the level of new energy and like interest in learning and trying new things, right? That you need to be successful in this moment. I would much rather be somebody who is on the outside, frankly, who's got some time and some passion and some drive to be in a learner's mindset right now. So like in terms of advice, what I would say is, take advantage of this precious time. And I'm not talking about 9 months for you, there's no deadline. As long as you're able to afford food and an internet connection and some computer, and, you know, like, it could be 3 years from now, it could be 10 years from now, however long it takes you. The orientation in my mind should be, you've learned these fundamentals, you have these tools available to you. Like, if the way to make money as a programmer is to generate value for somebody, then start building valuable things. And if it's just you right now and you've built a whole bunch of hobby projects through Free Code Camp's like resources, and you've, you know, maybe, done some sort of passion projects to kind of like, you know, prove that you can build a real functioning web application, then great. Now ask yourself, and this is literally what I'm doing at my stage in my career right now, is the same thing. It's like, what are the problems in my life that are presenting the most friction, or what's an opportunity for me to build some software to like make my life a little bit easier, and then build that and use these tools, use what you've learned to build things that are of tremendous value to you, and don't let go. Don't stop working on them until you've seen them through to completion. And you do that once, guess what? That is exactly the same loop that like a business needs when a business needs custom software. And something that I learned a long time ago that blew my mind is that most programmers, like in Ruby on Rails was where I cut my teeth as a consultant and built a lot of like, because it was a productivity oriented framework, makes it easy to start and build new applications. All the applications look really conventional, you know, it has a whole lot of stuff about it that is beneficial towards the orientation of, I build apps from cradle to grave relatively quickly without a lot of rework. 99%, maybe not 99%, quite a high number of Ruby on Rails developers have actually never typed the CLI command Rails space new space name of project, right? Like, I was doing it probably once a week. Here's a random idea on a Friday. Like, oh yeah, build a little thing like this, right? And so I was used to that loop of building new things and shipping new things within like, I had a one weekend rule where by the end of the weekend, I'm shipping it and it's going on the internet one way or another, right? And I'd look around and I'd talk to other Rails developers and like, oh, I'd never actually started a new project before because I just showed up and this project already existed. And, you know, I just add another new model and another new controller to our hundreds of models and our thousands of controllers. And that's been my entire relationship with the framework. If you're learning right now and you're out there, it's like, build the new thing, build it to be valuable, see it through to completion. And once you've done that sort of like what we used to call the software development life cycle, like once you've done that for yourself on something that you really care about and you've felt that like the wind at your back, now just the next step is get in touch, find a way, talk to somebody who's got a business that needs software and congratulations. Like that's basically, you've built a consulting company that can provide real business value. And the reason you can, you know, lean on your own experience to know, like, you have the capability to do it because you did it for yourself. And now when you go up against the person who's got 10 years, 15 years, 20 years of professional software development experience, maybe they fucking worked at Google or Meta or whatever, you know, you're actually going to be able to outcompete those people because you're going to be able to actually serve somebody and demonstrate as an individual how you're going to generate ROI for their business. Whereas the person who's just been sort of in like middle management or in like maybe even a principal level developer at Netflix, right? And all they've done is make the CDN go like marginally faster. You take that fish out of water and you put them in the same context. They're not going to be able to build a custom software or build a project cradle to grave for like a real use in the world. And so that's why, like in your truck driving example, like that person has tremendous capability right now to actually outcompete the people who are in professional programming jobs, even if they've got the CS degree and gobs of years of experience.
Okay, so if I'm understanding you, I'm going to repeat some of the things you said. Start building valuable things. Go from cradle to grave. Go through the entire software development lifecycle, which could be condensed to a single weekend, which sounds like a constraint that you placed on yourself to make sure that you had like closure and that you actually got things done in time. Because of course,
I had work on Monday.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great constraint. And one thing that you said that was very heartening is when you're going up against somebody with 10 years of experience, if they're at like a big tech company, they're probably extremely specialized. I remember talking to somebody who their entire job was just to manage kind of like the YAML file. I think it was like one of the YAML files for like a CDN, right? Like that was their job at Cloudflare, was they just literally had a single file and they made sure everything worked in that file. That's how specialized these jobs can get at big tech companies where you've got, you know, potentially tens of thousands of developers.
And that right? person might've made 400, 500 grand a year in total comp. Who knows? Right. That's it's totally irrelevant to the actual value that you can provide outside the context of the big companies.
Do you think that those types of jobs are going to go away to an extent and give way to more generalist developers who can do the entire software development lifecycle themselves?
Yes. I mean, I wrote a post last July called Full Breadth Developers, and I don't know if you meant to tee me up as a segue to discuss that, but frankly, like...
Please.
I worry more about the people who are hyper-specialized, just like the people who like coding for the sake of coding, who just want to be handed a spec and then they push out a servlet or something. Those people are going to be in trouble, right? It sounds condescending because it's meant to be, who are order takers here, who just like want to have a transactional relationship with the work. And then they want to be able to clock out and not think about it very hard. Or think about the broader context of that work in a similar way here. If you are just trying to be a lost cog in a gigantic machine, yes, like these tools, the more human-like that they're able to act and the more tools that we're able to equip to a Claude code, right? Or to an agent, God forbid we get to the point where like we've got biped robots running these things, but like every few months you saw the Claude bot, Molt bot, Open Claw thing now where it's like people are running a Mac Mini with essentially an agent that's got access to their messages and their mail. And yes, there's lots of security concerns, but like now it's like the entire, say you're an executive assistant who works remotely. It's like, uh-oh, like this is the entire kind of domain of what I can do. That's a lot. Like if you just fill particular cog roles of transactional, features on behalf of like a bigger system, you're in trouble. But if you are breadth first and you think in terms of what's the full life cycle of like, you know, like in terms of a company, I was talking about like startups and businesses and, you know, just kind of building a whole project just by yourself earlier. But if you just think in terms of, let's say you work in a medium or a large business, like you want to sit somewhere, like every company makes money, right? Like, in some way or other, like there's somebody paying the company money, and then that money trickles down one way or another to beneficiaries, like shareholders, like me in the form of salary, like the best seat in the house as an employee, as somebody involved in that business is going to be in the line of sight between where the dollars come in and where the dollars come out. Like, what is the thing that's actually getting people to pay that company money? And how is that like value ultimately disseminated out from the company? And what I think people are finding is that, you know, as a lot of these companies, like I learned from looking at the Decoder podcast feed yesterday that DocuSign has 7,000 employees. There's no earthly way that all 7,000 of those employees are like really, really vital to how that business makes money. Like if I was in that organization, I might feel under threat if I was in an ancillary like location in it. But if I was in like, you know, the ion cannon of like how people who just need a stupid contract signed, if I wanted one job at DocuSign, I want to be the one in charge of like the on click handler on the JavaScript of when you click the signature box, because that's the one thing that has to fucking work there. Right. Like I don't want to be, you know, the YAML configurator for their CDN, so to speak, to your point, Quincy, because like, yes, that role is probably going to get pushed aside as businesses increasingly are going to focus on what's my core competency and what is secondary. And the secondary stuff is going to get pushed because the secondary stuff, you can accept good enough. You can accept barely works, right? But the core competency, the thing that's your differentiator that really makes you money, I wish that companies would demand excellence and in that regard, but it has to at least be enough to convince somebody to pay them money for. And those are the areas that, like, you know, a human who is a generalist, who's able to, like, pick their head up and look above the keyboard and monitor level and think about the bigger context here of how humans are actually going to want to part with their dollars in order to get this value, those people are going to be much, much better situated.
Awesome. So we've talked a lot about how getting into software development, like the individual devs, their strategy, but it can be helpful to empathize with managers and how they think about software as well. And you've kind of already gone in that direction. You were a manager for like 2 decades, basically running this consultancy, this software development firm, working with clients. And I really want to understand how managers think about software. So you said something that I thought was pretty profound and interesting. You said businesses don't understand software and they see it as a big black hole that costs them a lot of money. How do you think this is informing how a lot of like less technical people who are in managerial roles think about AI tooling? And of course they want the panacea. Oh, we don't have to have developers on staff anymore. Right? Like, I don't know what your thoughts on that are, as far as like whether managers truly believe that or whether that might actually become a future that comes to pass. But can you talk about like that cost center mindset that most managers have regarding software?
Put yourself in the shoes of somebody who maybe you own a small business or you work in an organization where like your job is maybe you work in a business unit for like an online learning platform. And, your job is to like, maybe it's really, I'm just making shit up, right? Like maybe you really successful in K-12 and you've been hired now as like the business development for figuring out how to sell into, vocational schools and community colleges, the same sort of learning management system. So it's like a brand new, you know, business domain, a new kind of like, addressable market, a new place to sell into. So you got to think about those sorts of things, right? Like hire a sales force and figure out how to like, a marketing strategy. But like the system that's designed for K-12 is surely going to have to change for the needs of a commuter college, right? And maybe the business is like, all right, well, here's your budget and here's your timeline and here's our engineering team. You got to go work with them to figure it out. I guarantee you that that non-technical business manager is going to have a lot more fun engaging with everybody else other than that engineering team. Why? Because traditionally the engineering team, and this partly comes from the, you know, in the olden days, maybe it was because they're more technical. And so you can get away with being, you know, demonstrating the kind of antisocial behavior of the stereotypical nerd computer-y type, right? Because you have everyone at an informational disadvantage. There's an asymmetry to being the engineer because you receive your instructions in English and then you do some black box stuff that nobody else can understand, like a seer, and then you spit back out like working software that they can engage in. And so because of that power dynamic, engineering organizations, whether they're an external agency like me as a software consultancy or you as an internal, like, you know, software developer, you can kind of stiff arm people. You can say, oh no, you can't tell us how long this is going to take. We tell you how long this work's going to take. And so you put the business manager, maybe who's under a lot of traditional business constraints. I've got this budget and this timeline, right? And I know that the software has to change in this certain amount of way. So you go to the development team, you go to the engineers and you're like, all right, so we need the software to do this. And it's got to be done by, and then like you get cut off immediately and be told by the developers like, oh no, we estimate the work. And then it just takes what it takes because we have a certain level of quality that we need, right? Like, and then, you know, you go along with what they say. You're like, okay, oh, well, the system needs to do this. Oh, well, it can't do that. And like, maybe it really can't do that. Or maybe the developer is just being lazy and not thinking of a creative third approach that would work for everyone. Whatever it is, this sort of, very adversarial relationship that developers have had as they have stuff thrown over the fence at them for all these different reasons, right? Like most managers have had adversarial relationships and have not experienced. This is what it was like Agile was all about, like truly collaborative, you know, constructive, positive sum relationships with developers. And so like, yeah, if you could just replace that or externalize it or minimize that, or kind of like, you know, like I know people who are middle managers who are non-technical who are now like building proofs of concept and building MVPs that, yeah, they got security issues. Yeah, they're not perfect, but like they're giving a glimpse to a world of like now they can feel agency in their roles, right? So as a consultant, I so often, it's been literally 2 days since a founder asked me, okay, so like this piece of software, I've shown you the click-through demo, the Figma prototype. How long is it going to take and how much money is it going to cost to build it? And the answer to that question is like, in his case, between $50,000 and $5 million. And like figuring out how to narrow that range just requires a lot of collaborative exercises and hard decisions and a certain amount of time and uncertainty to like come and arrive at that answer. And so like if I'm, you know, my advice to anyone who's in a management role right now is to understand that like these tools will help you both understand a little bit more about software, build a little bit of it yourself and kind of like touch the flame and figure out a little bit, like be able to at least like check some of the things that you're hearing from developers. Hey, my developers just said all this stuff. Is that realistic or is that bullshit given these sets of constraints, right? Like have some little, like a little bit more traction on your own part. But separate from that, like I would really encourage you to find developers who are interested, these full breadth developers who are actually interested in conversing with you and like, you know, like meeting you halfway on the collaboration front, who want to understand your business problems as much as you want to understand like the software that you're going to get out the other end, who can work with you to arrive at answers like how long is it going to take and how much is it going to cost? And so when you look at these organizations who in the post COVID hiring spree ballooned into 2000, 3000, 4000, 5000 human organizations, like you can't organize a business, whether it's divisional or functional, without having like, you know, like a lot of siloing and a lot of handoff and a lot of bureaucracy. And as we experience a lot of layoffs and there's a certain scrappiness and as people like me are going on the internet saying teams are over, you know, one man shows are the future for developing software, thanks to the productivity provided by agents. I think that if I'm a manager, I'd be like, find the really good, you know, collaborative developer who I want to work with, who can provide the capacity, maybe thanks to all this AI stuff. But at the end of the day, what I used to be looking for was like a department that was like to minimize the amount of risk of that my project was going to fail. Going forward, if I was like, you know, a non-technical business person, I'd be looking for a partner, a technical co-founder, somebody that I could trust, build a relationship with, and then build a firm foundation as peers, as opposed to going down this traditional route of, and that's why I think a lot of like legacy companies that have, you know, business people, BAs, you know, PMs and all this sort of like part of the organization, and then a very large engineering organization, they're going to be outflanked and outmoded pretty quickly by much smaller and scrappier outfits. Just like we saw in the 2010s and a smaller scale, it's just like now it's going to go from being, you know, the order of magnitude of 20,000 people at IBM to 2,000 people at GitHub to like, you know, maybe two rungs down from 20 people organizations that are able to outflank something that big.
Yeah, that's a great example of how like the organizations have historically been shrinking because you had IBM and then that shrinked. And you've got like, you know, defense contractors and all these huge organizations developing sophisticated systems. And then the tools improve. For example, we get Git, for example, which is a huge improvement. We get high-level scripting languages, things like that. And then suddenly the teams can contract dramatically in size. And then, you know, so you think that phenomenon is going to keep happening and it might go down to like 20 person companies. And I guess my question is, and I think the question that a lot of people are going to have is, does the world have enough room for enough products and brands and consultancies and all these different, like, can the ecosystem actually accommodate 30 million professional developers when, you know, everything is essentially so balkanized? I'm not sure what the right word to use, but like compartmentalized, where like, hey, we build this very specific thing that does this very specific thing and everybody integrates with us. Like, what do you think is going to happen to the total volume of employment? Let's say like right now there are approximately 30 million people on Earth whose sustenance comes from shipping software. Go ahead.
I think that's a super interesting question if you're a macroeconomic professor, or if you work at like the Federal Reserve and you're trying to figure out like, are we in a recession? Or if you're thinking about like total employment as a politician, like those are all really like, yes, the answer to that question is very important. As an individual, I don't think it matters at all. I think as an individual, if you exhibit the kind of traits being described today and deploy the tools and stay where the heat is by focusing how to deploy those as a means towards building valuable things for people, I think you're going to be fine. Right. I think ultimately scrappiness and a desire to serve other people and provide value to them has throughout every era of humanity, resulted in pretty good outcomes for people. And so getting lost in the weeds of like, do we have more programmers than we need? Yeah, probably. Like, what's the number? I don't really care. It doesn't really matter to me, because the people who are doing the right things with the right motivation and the right orientation, they're going to be the absolute last on the chopping block. And that matters more, right, than understanding like, well, is the industry shrinking and so forth.
Awesome. Well, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to talk about. Like, I have so many questions, but we're already at approximately 80 minutes into the interview, and we've already covered so much ground. Is there anything you'd like to talk about, like in the vein? Like, have I missed any major topics just on the scope of what we've been talking about? Because I don't want to branch off into a completely different area. And I want to remind everybody, this is totally unedited. Like, a lot of things that Justin's saying, I may not fully agree with, but my goal is just to draw insight out of him. And, this is an uncensored, like, just his thoughts. And I want to respect your thoughts and the learned experience, the lived experience that has led to you having kind of this worldview. And, it's very exciting. I think for many people, it's also very scary. Like many kind of technological revolutions, if you want to look at like LLM code generation and the ability for like semi-technical people to essentially create their own MVPs, and then minimum viable products, and then be able to go to developers and say, I want something like this, and to push back, right? What you're talking about, like, the managers are much more empowered than they've ever been, because the black box is a little bit more scrutable than it used to
Yes.
be. Yeah. Like, are there one question I have is, any big developments that are likely to come out of this change dynamic between developers and the people who give developers money?
I think it's true. We have covered a lot of good ground today. And, if any of your listeners want to hear me just give a stream of consciousness rant about this and other related topics, you can check out my solo podcast, Breaking Change, where that's kind of all you get. And until my throat hurts and then I stop. That's usually the end of the show. The answer to your question is everything is going to change, and it is scary. Change is scary. You know what? Like, I'm, in addition to being a bad computer science student who went into it because I thought it would be hard, and then I was proven right that it was too hard. and I came out the other end having not learned nearly as much as my peers and then panicking that I wouldn't be able to find a job. I was also really scared of change. I still am. I'm a cozy cat. You know, I want to have the same routine. I want to be at home every day. I just found that I knew deep down though, that like change and embracing new opportunities and saying yes to stuff and forcing myself out of my comfort zone would probably make me more resilient and more likely to be successful and less likely to be caught in a corner without a lot of options. And so when I was coming out of school, somebody suggested that I go into consulting, and that sounded terrifying because every 3 months, every 6 months, I'd have a new client, new people to learn, new people to impress, to make like me. I'd have, brand new project. I'd be switching between programming stacks and ecosystems all the time, going from like Java to like Cognos reporting to like database, administration stuff to, you know, and I'll be honest, the first several years of that, I can't believe my wife stayed with me through it, because every single time I felt like I was drowning. I'd start a new project and I'd look around at the code and be like, I don't understand how all this works. I don't understand how any of this works. I don't understand. Like, they're telling me they want me to have stuff done by Friday. I don't even understand how, like, how to get this thing to run or build yet. I don't even know what we're doing here. And I'd get panicky. Right. And it was a really hard few years for me, but it, almost like some sort of exposure therapy. I didn't come out the other end with a thicker skin. I came out the other end with like a deeply understood, a deeply innate understanding that like change is actually safer, that the constant, like, and the continuous, embrace of fail fast, you know, admit that you don't really know what you're doing. Understand that a lot of other people don't either. That every single one of those hard experiences can be, feed into a pattern recognition machine of making you better at the job, for the next go round. All of those things are really helpful. And like, you know, like when, the financial collapse happened shortly into my career, I realized like, actually the consultants were, yes, the first ones kicked out the door, but they were also the first ones hired back. And so like, you know, the idea that, you know, your full-time job is where you're going to get your security from. No, the security comes from the resiliency of you as an individual and your ability to, you know, show up and do the work, at the moment that the company needs it on the terms that the company is willing to work with you on. And so when you say like, you know, what's this change going to look like and how are things going to change? I just want to like put out there, like, that change is coming. It is inevitable. It is going to be bigger than anything that we have experienced as an industry, probably, maybe ever, but at least in 30 years. And that is really, really scary. And so just like we talked about earlier, like you don't want to, settle for a role where you're kind of in a job where you just have to kind of like punch in, punch out and turn your brain off. Figuring out how to get excited about embracing that, you know, scary thing. You know, people ride roller coasters for a reason. You know, like I get sweaty palms. I live 5 minutes away from like Disney World and Universal Studios in Orlando, Florida. I've got like essentially unlimited passes to like, you know, like annual passes to go and ride stuff. I still get sweaty palms before every single ride. I'm still terrified. And I force myself to go on it. And I become a little bit more resilient every time. And so I think about that a lot in terms of, yes, I think that the relationship is going to change and no one knows the future. So don't let anyone tell you how it's going to be because nobody knows. I don't know. I've got some ideas and I can extrapolate. But that the you talked about how things are like these outcomes are not equitable. What this future is going to look like is not going to be evenly distributed for everybody. And the things that you're going to be asked to do as a professional, as a programmer, the things that you're going to have to face in terms of what that change looks like for you is going to be different than what it looks like for the person next to you. And the best thing that I can offer here is pay attention, embrace the change, understand it's going to be new, novel, hard, but like trust yourself to respond based on all of the things that you've built for yourself and the foundation that you have built. And that's why values and principles are so important and kind of like, you know, you understanding who the you is that's showing up to the thing and understand like no one has all the answers. Like that's the nice thing about change is like, oh, but I'm new here and I'm in my 40s and I'm just now starting out as a programmer and all these other people have been here so long. It's like, yeah, like, those people have ossified and calcified and like they to a certain extent now they have to break out of that. You have the plasticity and the beginner's mindset to actually succeed and thrive in this novel landscape where other people are going to struggle. And so wherever you're at and however you come at this from, it's all about mindset and our willingness to push ourselves outside of our comfort zone. That's going to determine how well we adapt to that change.
Yeah. Change is actually safer. That's pretty profound. I really appreciate you sharing your perspective and not pulling any punches, not sugarcoating it for the folks tuning in, that they've got a lot of work ahead of them, and it's going to be novel work that there's no playbook that they can fall back on. That all, you know, big changes are coming. It's scary. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast, Justin. Everybody, be sure to check out the links in the show notes to learn more about Justin, get more of his perspective. It's been really helpful reading your blog, and I've learned a lot from it. And until next week, everybody, happy coding.
Thanks, Quincy. I appreciate it.